From WAMU at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Joining us later in the broadcast will be Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. And joining us now is Bo Shuff, the executive director of D.C. Vote. Bo Shuff, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to D.C. Vote, Tom Sherwood, it can be said that one of the major initiatives of Maryland Governor Larry Hogan was the expansion of toll lanes on the Capitol Beltway and Interstate 270. And he's received a lot of pushback on that, but the latest one he's received is probably the strongest one yet from the Washington Council of Governments Transportation Planning Board. Tell us about what's going on there.
Well, the Council of Governments Transportation Planning Board is the organization, regional organization, that does stacks of various highway projects that have to have environmental and other approvals. And they narrowly voted this week, 16-13, with four abstentions, to remove Governor Hogan's big plan for adding these toll lanes to I-270 and I-495. It's unclear what that means for the American Legion Bridge. And the governor's administration has to scramble now to try to either reverse this vote or come up with something different in his final year or so in office. But this is the biggest defeat of Larry Hogan since his time in office. He has been bragging on national television, as some people think he's preparing to try to run for president in 2024, about how he did this fabulous private-public partnership to ease the transportation problems in the suburban Washington area. This is a bigger defeat than the General Assembly this year overriding his veto of the Kerwin Commission, which was to add billions of dollars to state education funding. So that's where we are now. As a person who just this past Sunday was stuck on I-495 in Sunday afternoon traffic, I know how desperately people in the region want those roads to be prepared. But right now, we do not know the way forward.
Any opinion on this, Bo Shuff? Were you also stuck in traffic this weekend?
I have the very nice luxury of living close enough in the city to use public transportation and other forms. I don't own a car. So I was not stuck in this traffic, and I'm concerned about other gridlock in D.C.
Lucky you.
Communist.
Lucky you. And Tom Sherwood, let's go to Virginia for a second, because Amazon is going to provide, it would appear, $125 million in financing for 1,000 units of affordable housing on land that Metro owns in the D.C. region. How significant is that?
Well, to you and me and most of our listeners, $125 million is a lot of money. Maybe to Amazon, it's lunch money. But it is a significant thing. We desperately need this region tens of thousands of affordable homes for people in the $40,000 to $100,000 a year range for people, families of four. Amazon is not giving this money. It is loaning this money to developers at lower interest rates and better rules than maybe banks can do, and teaming up with Metro to make certain that there's housing. You know, it itself is trying to have like 37,000 employees at its new headquarters in Arlington. And so it's trying to do something to help what we desperately need in this region, which is workforce affordable housing for families. It's not a grant. It's a loan to developers.
Why is it not a grant? It's not like Amazon can't afford a grant of $125 million.
well, you know, maybe they could end free shipping for a week and make enough. No, it's a major corporation. Amazon is coming to this region. It's going to be a Bigfoot. It is a Bigfoot. This is one way to be here. Perhaps more will be done in the future, but let's give the credit at least for starting the idea that it wants to help create the housing that we desperately need.
It's not. It's a major corporation. It's not in the business to give away money. Any comment, Beauchef?
No.
Listen, if you go outside, Gojo, if you go outside the District of Columbia confines, Bo is not the guy to ask any questions.
Unless it's about statehood. For that disclaimer.
Well, let's get back into the confines of the District of Columbia. Bo Schuff is the executive director of DC Vote. He's our guest. Bo, for those who don't know, tell us about DC Vote.
Yeah. DC Vote has existed for more than 20 years now, advocating for equality for the district residents, the 700,000 of us that call DC home, most presently through an effort to push forward DC statehood and make DC the 51st state. We work across the country educating Americans on what it is like to live here in the district and what it means to be a district resident.
When did you get involved in this?
I've been at DC Vote for 5 years now. And have been pretty much ever since the ballot initiative in 2016, have been working and pushing on and educating on this issue.
How long have you been living in this area?
I have lived in D.C. off and on. I work in politics, so I have, you know, done projects across the country, but I've been here off and on since 1991, even though I was born in Fairfax a significant number of years before that.
He was one of the principal political consultants who helped get Mayor Bowser elected in 2014.
Oh yeah, we'll get to that in a second.
He's got a record here.
I know. Tell us about the Senate committee hearing next week, Bo, and where does this fall in the overall push for DC statehood?
I mean, the Senate hearing on Tuesday in the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee is an important step. We have not had a committee hearing for seven some odd years, and even that last time we had a committee hearing in the Senate, it wasn't while the bill was sort of in play. It wasn't going to move through the House at that point, and it wasn't going to move in the Senate. It's vastly different now. We've moved it through the House. We passed the House of Representatives in this Congress. We passed it also in last Congress. Those are the first two times in history that that bill has passed after 200 years of trying. So it's a completely different picture than we've ever seen before, and it represents the farthest step forward for the movement and for the effort.
Tom Sherwood.
Well, you know, this is the Senate committee. It's the Committee on Homeland Security and Government Affairs. It's run by the Democrats, but there are equal numbers of Republicans on it, and some of those Republicans are pretty well known for, critics would say, wackadoodle ideas. Rand Paul of Kentucky, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. So I'm just thinking, when we had the House hearing earlier this year, we got wackadoodle questions or comments that D.C. couldn't be a state because it doesn't have an airport. D.C. can't be a state because it doesn't really have industry. D.C. doesn't have
fishermen. We don't have fishermen.
Yes, all of which is almost said it. That's all of which is BS. What kind of, I know there was an effort for the mayor had a test group. She practiced appearing before the House members and expecting some of that wackadoodle questioning. I don't know if she's done one this time for the Senate, but what kind of questions are you expecting, not from the Democrats, but from the Republicans on this committee?
You know, I would hope that as we move into the Senate, we're going to see some serious examination. I think that there are some concerns from folks who oppose statehood about constitutionality and about other pieces, and we would hope that it would be a serious conversation about the merits of the bill. The fisherman one drives me the most crazy because we have the longest continuously operating fish market here in the district. Tom, you know this. It's in your neighborhood.
Yes.
And we get criticized that we had, you know, with dog whistle critiques of our workforce here. I think that we will hear some of that again, but I am hopeful that the Senate is going to delve into the merits of the issue and why it matters that 700,000 people are unrepresented.
Is the mayor going to have anything to say differently to the Senate than she said to the House, or is it pretty much set what the issue is?
I think that the mayor did a fantastic job in the House hearing, and I can't imagine that the core issue and the core messages are no different, right? It is about 700,000 people who pay taxes and are not represented. It is about a majority white body overseeing a majority or a person of color district. It is about enfranchising people who have lived here. It is about the safety of our nation's capital, like we saw on January 6th. And it's about the ability for people to go about governing themselves, one of the core values of American democracy. And so I don't think that the core arguments are going to change very much. I think the mayor is going to be set and well prepared for any questions that come her way, but I can't imagine at this point she hasn't answered all of them in various forums.
Our guest is Bo Shuff, the executive director of DC Vote. As Tom mentioned earlier, Bo Shuff served as the campaign manager for Muriel Bowser's mayoral campaign in 2016. Is that correct, Bo?
2014, but yes.
2014, yes. Well, I get my years mixed up. Here is Paul in Arlington, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I feel that the basic idea of D.C. being a special district is a sound one, so that the federal government can't be pushed around, harassed, whatever, by concerns of local politics. What I have felt for a long time is that certainly the boundaries of D.C. could be retrenched to a certain extent, but I also feel that the residents of D.C. ought to maintain their voting status in whatever state they last lived in before moving to D.C. And if someone was born in D.C., then they could inherit a sort of voting status in a state from their parents. And if their parents were born in D.C. also, then maybe some sort of lottery could be held to assign the remaining residents to voting rights in some particular state. I think that would be a good way to solve the problem by constitutional amendment without going to the extreme of making D.C. a state of its own.
How about the fact that D.C. residents pay federal taxes and serve in the military in wars all over the world?
Well, again, they could do that as citizens of whatever state they were assigned
another state.
To.
Okay, here's Bo Shuff.
Sure. It's interesting that the caller presents the idea of statehood as the complex one or as the extreme one. I think what's extreme is taking a tight, close-knit jurisdiction and making different people within that jurisdiction vote in different ways. Some of you get to vote here. Some of you get to vote in Massachusetts because your mom lived there. Some of you get to vote in Idaho because you won a lottery or lost a lottery, depending on your perspective on Idaho. That's not how we do things in the United States of America. In the United States of America, we have a given jurisdiction that requests statehood. It's happened 37 times, in fact, and we've said yes every single one of those times. That jurisdiction says we're going to do it under this constitution, we're going to do it with this set of laws, this name, these boundaries, and we promise to be a representative form of government. That's what's required for a given jurisdiction to come into the country as a state. In the scenario laid out by the caller, who would decide on the schools in D.C.? The voters that vote now in Idaho, or the Idaho legislature, or that doesn't follow naturally. I also find it interesting that the caller is calling from Arlington, a area that was part of D.C., where the self-determination of the people of Northern Virginia decided that wasn't what they wanted for themselves, and both the Congress and the legislature of Virginia agreed. That's all we're asking for as Washington residents, is that the Congress and our own legislature, the D.C. District Council, go with what the people have requested, and they did that in 2016 at a margin of 86%. The simplest, cleanest answer is to take the space where our schools, our parks, our houses, our roads are, make that into the 51st state, and preserve the nation's capital for the rest of America, for all of America, that contains the Capitol building, the White House, the Mall, and the monuments. It's a very simple, clean solution. It parallels what we've done throughout history, and it recognizes the fact that the people of D.C. are not part of any other place and shouldn't be required to pseudo-join it in order to get what is provided to all Americans.
What do you think about that, Paul?
That's a lot to think about. I can't come out with a definitive answer. My initial...
That's the whole point, though. There's a lot to think about. Yes. There's a lot to think about. Tom Sherwood.
People have heard me talk against a retrocession, which is a different form of what the caller just asked. But some people have said, well, just give the remaining land of the district back to Maryland from whence it came, carve out the small area for the federal district from the White House to the Congress, and then we'd all be happy because we would have statehood in Maryland, and we could vote for senators and congresspeople and all of that. I am opposed to that in part because I don't want to join Maryland, but more importantly, Maryland doesn't want to join us. But what would that do if we just retroceded ourselves back to Maryland? First, of course, Maryland would have to approve it, and it's not interested.
Yeah, I think it goes to the same points that I was trying to make with the caller, is that our fundamental values in America are about self-determination, that the people who are governed based on their own consent. And the consent of Maryland and the consent of the Washington residents are to make D.C. a state, not to retrocede this piece of land back to Maryland, which is an interesting concept because D.C. hasn't been part of Maryland. You know, Texas was part of Mexico longer than D.C. was part of Maryland. So this idea that we're just the same is completely just wrong. We've decided as a people that we want to be a full and equal state. And there's no legal or ethical reason why it shouldn't happen. Even if you just look at the technicalities of how the district would become part of Maryland, which laws then rule? Is it the laws passed by the Maryland legislature, or is it the laws passed by the district council? And are we going to have to negotiate every single one of those? Whether it's a speeding limit or our approach to marijuana or anything, all of those would have to be legislated versus the idea of following the pattern we've done 37 times and admitting D.C. as a state and allowing our self-governance to continue and be respected by the Congress instead of overturned.
It would cost a lot of money, billions of dollars, for the district to carry on all its, like covering the prisons and other types of things that we would have to do, Medicaid funding and all of that. Would there be a commuter tax? There are several hundred thousand suburbanites who come into the district every day to work, at least when there's not a pandemic. Would they be subject then to a D.C. commuter tax if they were to work here but live in the suburbs still?
The most important piece of this whole conversation about the finances of them are that the choices on how to fund the district should be up to the people of the district, either directly through referendum or through their elected officials. Even now, even though we supposedly won budget autonomy, it's still up to review from Congress. We just saw another rider introduced today to tell the school board how they can and cannot teach matters related to race from a congressman in Wisconsin. Once the people of the District of Columbia are in control of our own finances fully, and those can't be overridden by the U.S. Congress, then we can decide how to continue to balance budgets and operate fiscally responsibly. There's a variety of ways that revenue and expenditures can be raised or lowered to balance those budgets, but those choices need to be made by the people, not by any outside entities.
Let me, Kojo, if you'll let me have one more question. The committee is meeting.
Well,
committee is meeting on Tuesday. It is an equally divided committee with the Democrats running it. Will there, in fact, it's a hearing on Tuesday. Will there, in fact, be a vote in the committee? And has the Speaker Schumer agree? Senate President Schumer committed to bringing it to the floor if it, in fact, passes the committee? We're not even sure. There's going to be a committee vote.
That's true. We expect the hearing is a hearing, right? There are two steps, and at some point there will be a committee markup when a vote would be taken on amendments and then on final movement on the bill. So we don't expect any sort of vote on Tuesday. It is an opportunity for the senators to ask questions and hear testimony from the witnesses. But the next step is the next step. And what we look at the committee hearing as is an opportunity to educate Americans and the population on what this really means.
Are there any senators you'll be watching particularly closely in this hearing?
I am. There's one bipartisan. I am very much interested in what Senator Sinema from Arizona, her appearance and her participation. And I'm interested in Senator Romney as well from Utah, who has indicated some support for some sort of fix to our lack of representation, but hasn't indicated support that statehood is the answer. So it'll be interesting to see what he learns and what he is asking and what she learns and what she is asking from both of those senators.
Well, Jim from Glendale, Maryland, sent us an email, says, Are there some opportunities for adding a Republican state, I don't know what that is, at the same time that D.C. becomes a state, since maintaining a partisan balance is the real reason the Senate will not make D.C. a state?
Yeah, I think what the caller is referencing is what we commonly call the Noah's Ark theory, that for quite a bit of time, for different reasons, states were admitted two by two. Originally, that was based on the racist notions of slavery, that if a non-slave state came in, a slave state had to come in as well. And at one point, it modified slightly, and it was a Republican state and a Democratic state. And that's how some of the states have been admitted, but not all. There isn't necessarily a pairing at the moment that is prevalent, but most important, like it shouldn't be prerequisite. California, for example, came in all on its own with no pairing at all. So there's no reason that D.C. can't be admitted.
What about Puerto Rico? There is some suggestion that Puerto Rico would be more of a Republican-leaning state. I was in Hawaii in 1959 when Alaska and Hawaii were paired together. But why not Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, the idea that you mentioned Alaska and Hawaii, the idea that D.C. is always going to be Democratic or that Puerto Rico is always going to be Republican is sort of laid sideways by history, in that when Hawaii came in, it was always going to be Republican and Alaska was always going to be Democratic. So even the history doesn't bear out that this holds true for very long. But Puerto Rico is on a journey of self-determination as well. There are multiple solutions available in Puerto Rico. There's a large contingent pushing for independence. There's a large contingent pushing for statehood. And there's a contingent that is fine with the status quo. So I think that the people of Puerto Rico need to make clear their decision and their desires and work towards that. But self-determination, again, is the fundamental value of both of those scenarios. But the people of D.C. should no longer be denied full representation while any other process is going on.
Well, it's interesting that former Senator Joseph Lieberman will be speaking at the hearing. Remind our listeners who may not be familiar with who he is, and why he was chosen as a witness, what he's expected to say.
Yeah, I mean, Senator Lieberman he was the Democratic nominee for vice president in 2000. He then, though, ran for re-election as an independent and is seen as a moderate, leaning independent from the Democratic caucus. I think that's important. I think that's why the senators have asked for him to participate, is that it is a moderated position to admit D.C. as a state. It has been supported. There's an article out in The Atlantic today about the long history of Republican support for voting rights and equality in the District of Columbia. We know that it's part of the Democratic platform presently, but it for a long time was part of both parties' platforms. And so I think former Senator Lieberman, is going to be able to speak to some of that, how it fits with American values and really is a mainstream position.
Here is Elizabeth in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth, we only have about a minute left, but go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks so much. I just want to say that, you know, we did start to see during the Trump administration and then during the pandemic that not having representation really does have a lot of impacts, including life and death impacts that we bear. And I'm a lifelong Washingtonian. I'm a native born here. And I want to know, you know, why is it that we still have to pay federal tax? Why isn't it either, you know, no taxation or taxation with representation?
Beauchef?
You know, when I talk to Washingtonians and when I talk to about this idea of are just not paying taxes anymore, most of the folks
you've
that
only
I
only got about 40 seconds left.
Right. The people of Washington are responsible Americans. We want to be part of it. We also know that taxes fund important things. And so we're perfectly fine being part of the obligation or meeting our obligation and being part of the community. We just want the representation that is supposed to come with it. So it's not a position I favor to end all taxes for D.C. I also think there would be some really big problems with gentrification should that happen. But it is about being responsible members of the community and being treated equally in how we're represented.
Fred, we're out of time. After this hearing, we'll find out what the next step are for the statehood bill in the Senate. Beauchef is the executive director of GZ Vote. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Up next, Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Christina Henderson, an at-large member of the D.C. Council. She is an independent. Christina Henderson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo. It's good to be here.
Tom Sherwood, Arlington is finally poised to rename Lee Highway after John M. Langston, who apparently was the first black elected official in the United States.
Elected to Congress from Virginia.
That is, yes. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you know, this is the ongoing effort by not only Virginia, but virtually every jurisdiction in the country to reconsider whose name for what and what it means for the people who live in the in these jurisdictions now. Lee Highway, of course, named after Robert E. Lee, is not the image that the Arlington wants to have. And so they're going to be voting to name it now the Langston Boulevard, I believe, is the way it's going to be called. And out of respect for him, he was an abolitionist from the 1880s. He also was at Howard University and helped start the law school. He has a regional impact here, not only the national impact. So it sounds like a good thing that's going to happen. And this will be continuing throughout the state of Commonwealth of Virginia and others, where we are trying to write our recognition of history.
And you know, Christina Henderson, they talk about critical race theory, but the fact of the matter is that most of us were not taught one darn thing about John Langston when we were going to school, and we now find out about him and some places being named after him, and there are people who object to that. Christina Henderson, any opinion?
And also, is that the Langston Golf Course? Is that the same person? I'm not certain.
I am not sure.
Yeah. Here in D.C.
I mean, I would say this. I think that, the racial reckoning that has been happening across the country and particularly in our region over the last few years is a good thing. The more that we can learn about our history, the more that young people can learn about their history and, you know, the various successes and struggles, I don't see anything wrong with that. And it's unfortunate that some people are threatened by that.
It's amazing. Tom Sherwood, Virginia. $500 to lure people back to work. They're saying they're going to give $500 to employees who return to work at small businesses across the Commonwealth, because a lot of small business owners are complaining that employees are not coming back. And I suspect they feel that it's because the employees have been the beneficiaries of unemployment benefits, and now they want them back.
Yes, they do. And excuse me, I just checked John Mercer Langston. That is the name for the D.C. golf course here in town. But just like lotteries and free beer and all kinds of things, people are being offered to, you know, go get a shot for the COVID virus because we're doing well, but too many people are not getting the vaccine. There are too many people who are not returning to work. There's a $300 a week federal stipend that goes with some unemployment insurance, and some people are contending, others disagree, that people who are getting so much money on unemployment insurance are not encouraged to go back to work. Some others say, you know, the minimum wage has not been raised since 2009. It's $7.25, and the federal minimum wage. And so many people are not going to work because they have learned that their jobs just don't pay enough. And so there's an effort in the federal government to raise the federal minimum wage to $15, like it is in the district, but over a period of time. So there are economic considerations. There are some people whose children are not yet back in school full time. There are lots of reasons people are not going back to work. But Virginia thinks that it can give a benefit of $500 to employees who go back to work, but it's limited to companies that have fewer than 100 people, and the most you can do is give it to 25 people in your company. But it's anything you can do to get people to go back to work is a good thing, people say.
And Tom Sherwood, you are right. The golf course is named after John Mercer Langston.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Christina Henderson, I'm going to start with you from a question we received from one of our listeners, who wants to know about legislation that you have proposed. She says, could you please ask Councilmember Henderson what is the status of her ranked choice voting legislation? And does she have enough co-sponsors to pass it in the new council?
Well, thanks for the question, whoever it was who submitted it. So we actually haven't introduced the ranked choice voting bill yet. The bill is complete. But we wanted to wait to do some more community engagement and then also see what's going to happen in New York City next week. New York City is a jurisdiction that for the first time will be using ranked choice voting for its mayoral and city elections this year. They have a lot of candidates, a lot of things there. And we actually think that what happens in New York can be very instructive and informative from a voter education standpoint of how you can switch things up and people still feel heard.
For those people who still don't understand, please explain how ranked choice voting works.
Right. So ranked choice voting is essentially another word or another term for that is instant runoff voting. In a runoff, which I think people are fairly familiar with, after the original election takes place, if no one has received 50% of the vote, the highest two vote getters go to a runoff and then you have another election. What is the good and beauty of ranked choice voting is that another election does not have to be called. All of that takes place at the time that you vote. So as opposed to choosing just one candidate, a voter has an opportunity to rank up to X number of candidates that they prefer. And then once the tabulation happens after the vote, if no candidate reaches 50%, they go through rounds until someone, a candidate, achieves the 50% and then therefore is elected.
Cool.
The Virginia Republicans in their semi-convention used ranked choice voting for their nominees for statewide office. That was pretty interesting.
Sure did. Christina Henderson, President Biden signed a bill yesterday making Juneteenth a new national holiday. Most federal and our D.C. government employees have today off to observe the holiday, which we've been doing for years. It's actually tomorrow, but not you. Since you're on our show, what do you think of the decision to make Juneteenth a national holiday?
Well, Kojay, I did close my office today. The council is closed today. But of course, I'm not going to cancel on you guys. This is such an honor to be here with you. But, I am glad that we were able to make Juneteenth a national holiday. I know that there are some activists who have been working on this for years, like Miss Opal Lee from Texas, who was a very strong advocate for this. I was a little surprised, I'm not going to lie, in terms of how quickly we implemented this legislation. I really thought that, we would take a year before we would, take a day off and those kinds of things. But I think the key piece here is that, I hope members of Congress are listening and don't feel that passing this holiday absolves them of the responsibility to handle some of the other issues, critical issues that have been affecting Black and Brown, constituents across the country, like voting rights and D.C. statehood.
Well, we had the hardest time ever persuading Tom Sherwood to work on Juneteenth, but here he is.
Well, you raised a serious issue because there is a concern that the House and the Senate overwhelmingly voted for Juneteenth. I think some of them don't even know exactly what it is. But there is a concern that, quote, let's give them a holiday and that'll calm things down, just so everybody can have a holiday. But so that's an important thing. I was concerned here in the district, even though it came up, it was just signed by the President Biden yesterday. Mm-hmm. So suddenly it's a holiday today, a work holiday today. The District of Columbia closed its recreation centers today and its indoor aquatic centers.
Right.
At the very time, people should be using those. I know the outdoor pools are open, but I was kind of surprised that that kind of service would also close.
Yeah, I had an opportunity to talk to some of the mayor's officials yesterday. We had a budget hearing about this in terms of, this is a really quick change. I myself, got one of those emails from my child's daycare center that was like, we're sorry for the late notice, but we're closed.
I know it
threw a lot of families off. And I'm hopeful that we could figure out a way. I know that there were some, end of school year celebrations and promotion celebrations that had to be canceled today. DC Public Schools, the last day of school is technically not until next Thursday. So I'm hopeful that school leaders will be able to reschedule those events for those young people. But I was out this morning with my daughter. The splash parks are full. Kids are out. Families are out. And really, I hope that while this was an inconvenience for folks, they do take an opportunity to sit down and talk with their families about the history of Juneteenth and why this is so significant.
And I think there is some confusion that, you know, D.C. has the D.C. Emancipation Day, right, April 16th, when slaves were freed in the District of Columbia. And, of course, Juneteenth, some people have asked, what is that? It's a combination of June and the 19th. And yep, when in Texas, it was announced to a couple years late that black people were no longer slaves.
Two and a half years after
Lincoln signed it.
A couple was within two and a half.
Christina Henderson, earlier we were talking about with Bo Schuff, the executive director of D.C. Vote, about next week's Senate hearing,
yes,
of the D.C. statehood bill. You used to work for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, so you have an understanding of how things work on the Hill. Mm-hmm. What would it take for D.C. statehood to pass the Senate, and do you think it's likely?
I want to remain as optimistic as possible, but you know, I'm excited that the Senate is going to hold a hearing. I don't think in a long time they haven't held a hearing on this particular issue. But when you look at the committee membership breakup of HISGAC, which is the Senate Committee on Homeland Security, I'm concerned. It may not even get out of committee because Senator Sinema from Arizona has expressed some. What's the word?
Sure has.
Reservations, if you will, or concerns. And you know, that committee has equal number of Republicans and Democrats. I think if we're able to get it out of committee, we might have a shot here. You know, frankly, the conversation to, you know, Senator Sinema or Senator Manchin or even Senator Angus King, who has expressed some reservations about the constitutionality of it, is around, you know, we have 700,000 people in the District of Columbia who deserve to have full representation and full voice. And frankly, you know, I was listening to your conversation earlier, you know, the congressman from the 6th District of Wisconsin introducing legislation to try to control what can be taught in D.C. public schools is exactly the reason why we need D.C. statehood. You know, the ability for us as citizens to be able to govern our own affairs. It's critical and it's important. And for me, frankly, it's right up there with voting rights. So, you know, if you're going to get rid of the filibuster, might as well do both.
Well, I was mentioning the wackadoodle aspects of the questions we got when the House had the hearing, and I expect some wackadoodle kind of questions from the Senate. But, you know, if I'm a Republican, if I'm a Republican senator, and I understand the core beliefs of Americans' right to vote and taxation without representation and all of those things, but I'm thinking if I vote for this and it becomes a state, there are two senators from the District of Columbia who, you'll bet any amount of money you want, bet the $125 million that Amazon is giving for housing in Virginia, that it's going to be two mostly liberal Democratic senators, and it would be self-defeating as a Republican if I voted for this.
Well, I think that if you were a Republican who thought that, that's a shame, right? It's a shame that
it's pretty cynical
that your party cannot compete on policy and ideals. Your party cannot compete if every single person votes. That's sad. And frankly, I would be embarrassed to admit that out loud. But that's what we've been hearing happening across the board. And so, you know, as we say, as the young people say, like, fight for my vote, compete for my vote. You know, there was a time in the District of Columbia where we had Republicans who were elected to office, right? There were Republicans who served on the D.C. Council. So to just assume that, you know, by allowing D.C. statehood, a Republican will never serve, you know, I would say have a little bit more hope.
The Republicans got elected only because they required that there be a mix of political parties on the council. And so I don't know that that's a good history lesson.
Well, my friend Carol Schwartz served on the council for a long time. Here's Jude in Southwest D.C. Jude, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. Thank you, Kojo. Hi, Tom. Hi, council member.
Hey, Jude.
Hello. I had a question for you. You actually brought it up already. The gentleman from Wisconsin who introduced the Banning Critical Race Theory in D.C. Public Schools Act, as a D.C. resident, I was personally offended that he had the gall to suggest what we teach in our schools. And I was curious about the council members' thoughts on that, both as an elected official of the district and as a D.C. citizen.
She briefly mentioned it earlier, but please go ahead, Christina Henderson.
Yep. So for those who don't know, Representative Glenn Grothman from Wisconsin's 6th District introduced legislation to end critical race theory in D.C. public schools. This is part of a campaign that has been happening with conservatives across the country. And, you know, I would say to the congressman, with all due respect, like, mind your business. You're not from D.C. You probably haven't even stepped foot in a D.C. public school. And your district looks very different than ours. And I feel like in the District of Columbia, in the nation's capital, we value the diversity that we have here, and we believe wholeheartedly that our young people need to learn the goods, the bad, and all in between about how America came to be today. And so, you know, that he's getting some press for it, but I imagine it's not going to go anywhere. And so, as it should, but I don't think that he should have even been able to single out the District of Columbia in this way, especially if this is something that he can't even get passed in his own district.
Let's go local, please. Tom Shelley?
Yes. Yeah, I want to go local to the banning of cigarettes, flavored cigarettes in the
District
of Columbia.
That's exactly where I was going, the banning of sale of flavored tobacco. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, you know, the Federal Drug Administration is going to ban menthol cigarettes pretty much soon, but the big concern I keep hearing is that the council passed this, got one more vote on it, but passed it, but there's an exemption for hookah bars, which where you go and smoke flavored smokes. But this is a concern for all the groups that are Flavors Hook Kids and all the 70 groups that support them, that you've opened a door to keep flavored cigarettes and cigars in the district, even if you ban them overall. What is the status of the effort to ban flavored cigarettes?
Indeed, you introduced an amendment to the bill that would exempt hookah bars from this ban. Why?
So I did the amendment to exempt hookah bars because when we look at where our hookah establishments are in the district, they're predominantly minority and immigrant-owned businesses. And, you know, I want to clarify for people, there's nothing in the legislation, the undergrounding legislation, that bans a hookah, right? The actual water pipe device. But it does ban, you know, the sale of flavored tobacco, which is really what is all that is used in a hookah.
Right.
And I felt that, you know, here we are, you know, coming out of the recovery of a pandemic, and we're about to put a bunch of immigrant-owned businesses essentially out of business to say that you can't do this thing. And so, you know, I worked with my colleagues, Councilmember Allen and Councilmember Che, to craft what I thought was a very narrowly tailored, you know, amendment that still limits the access of hookah bars, which, frankly, if you're not 21, you shouldn't be in a hookah bar anyway under existing law. And so, you know, this maintains it for just on-premises consumption only at these establishments. And frankly, it's a grandfathering. So it's only at these establishments that are in existence and in business by the end of September of this year.
That's very similar to what we did with strip bars. We limited the ones that we grandfathered in, the existing strip bars. I know the history of the district.
He also knows the history of strip bars. But go ahead.
why not? I understand the racial equity issues about the businesses that are struggling to survive through the pandemic, and now this is a possibility that they could be banned effectively from working. But why not maybe put something in for a long-term phasing them out because of the health issues around smoking? Nicotine is like twice as much in a hookah bar as it is in a cigarette.
Right,
and maybe give it three to five years to give them a chance to move on to something else.
Well,
smoking is what's bad.
I mean, Tom, as you just sort of said, right, the FDA has already signaled that next year they plan to ban flavored tobacco, including menthol. So in some ways, we have maintained a little bit of the longevity. But next year, the federal government does plan to act on this issue.
Right.
And so they will be out of business then, unless the federal government somehow decides to do you know, an exemption for menthol. Right. And I can't see that happening just given the research that they've produced on this issue.
Right. So that would meet my concern. That would be if FDA does it next year, then there'll probably be a short phase-in period or right. won't be a sudden. And so they'll give the people who are struggling already a chance to adjust. That's pretty good. Thank you.
Yep.
Ward 1 Councilmember Brianna Zoe pulled her sugary drinks tax bill last week. Mm-hmm. We're familiar with the bill because our show would regularly have call and efforts from local business owners who opposed the tax. Do you think it was the right decision to pull it?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm of the belief that we can always have a debate about a bill, right? Not every bill that introduced must have 9 or 13 or 7 members who are supporting it outright. I respect Councilmember Nadeau's decision. I know that this issue is incredibly important to her. But frankly, the votes were not there. And so perhaps in another council period with more community engagement and conversation, we could get there. But yeah, that was a decision that she made.
Okay, here now... Go ahead, Tom.
I want to ask a political question about you. You're the new council member, at large council member. You have a lot of competing demands on your time. I've talked to other council members and other elected officials and who say they've moved from being a staff person like you have been in the past in the council and Congress to being the council member. What's the big difference? And many of them say the big difference is I have to be careful what I say. Every word counts far more than it does when I was a staff member. Do you find that to be true as an elected council member, that you have to measure your words more than you did as a citizen or as a staffer?
Absolutely. I mean, I do try as much as I can to speak in plain language and just speak my truth. But it is definitely something that I think about, particularly on social media, about mining my words and, you know, how people are able to sort of read into something that I might have thought was innocuous, but is a very large deal to them.
I would also, council.
What's that now?
I'm sorry.
You got to stop doing that. Here's David in Washington, D.C. David, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo and Tom, and it's just such a pleasure to be here with you. I do have a serious concern, though, about the homeless encampment situation. We have an encampment across the street from my house that is just completely out of control. There are about 30 tents there. They've been there since long before winter, about when COVID started is when it started.
Okay, you only have about a minute left. Go ahead.
I just wanted to see, is there a holistic plan to help these people and also to bring back the public parks for the public's use as well?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. The encampment issue obviously is one that's grounded in a lot of different issues, not just housing, but also health, employment, and all of these various pieces. I think the Department of Human Services have been trying to work to create a balance, especially for individuals who don't necessarily feel safe going into the shelter system. And so one of the ways that I think that we resolve the campment issue is around increasing more affordable housing that we have in the city. And, you know, I think that there are some interesting investments, some good investments that are being proposed by the mayor in this budget to address some of our housing challenges and concerns. But it is something, you know, we're going to have to work on with the community.
Out of time, Christina Henderson is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kojo. It's good to see you. Virtually.
Well, hear us. The Politics Hour is produced by Sidney Grannon, and our managing producer is Ingelisa Schroffdorf. Our phone screener is the incomparable Bruce Romer. Tom Sherwood, big plans this weekend?
It's Father's Day, and my son is buying lunch.
And the Black Feathers Matter motorcade is on this Sunday. It takes place starting at the African-American Civil War Memorial at Vermont and New Street. It leaves at 12:30. I'll be there. You got to get there by 11 if you're going to get into it. But hopefully I'll see you there. Thank you all for listening, and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
Politics Hour with Kojo Nnamdi is produced by Sidney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schrobstorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Mike Kidd. Monica Ashby oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.